Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Well, hello there. I welcome myself to your ears for the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 202. Say, we have a YouTube channel. Will you please subscribe to it? It would really be awesome if you did. It's youtube.com/Nerdist. Tons of fun programming coming up. This next week, we are on All-Star Celebrity Bowling. We're bowling the cast of The Walking Dead and Robert Kirkman. We bowled them on the bowling show, and it was fantastic. So tune in for that. Also, Face to Face with Weird Al, new episode coming up. Episodes of Kids in the Hall, Ain't It Cool, Comic Book Club, Weird Shit from Japan. New shows launching soon, like Justin Willman's Magic Meltdown. Just a lot of fun stuff. Come be in the clubhouse. YouTube.com/Nerdist. And this episode of Nerdist Podcast, by the way, is brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup. Your life is on your computer, and it is your livelihood. And if anything happens to it, it's almost like losing your organs. So Carbonite will back up everything automatically in the background, keep it stored away from your machine safely and securely. And then whenever you need a file, or if you lose your computer, or if your computer takes crap in itself and you can't scoop it all out, then you get a new computer that's crap-free, and you can access, you can reinstall all of your files onto your hard drive. Or if you just need one file, you can use their smartphone app and go on and just access that file on your mobile device. Plans start at $59 a year, so start your free trial today at Carbonite.com with the code Nerdist, and get 2 bonus months with purchase. That's Carbonite.com. The offer code for 2 bonus months is Nerdist. Okay, this episode... I never thought this episode was going to go up. I really didn't. It's one of those episodes where we recorded it and then someone else recorded it for me and then I just never got the file. And then I got it ages later. And so now I'm putting it up. This is from SF Sketchfest 2011 in January of 2011. What the shit? SF Sketchfest did a tribute to the film Airplane for the 30th anniversary of the movie Airplane, the comedy which changed comedy in film. And we did it at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. And to see this movie again with like 1,000 people was so incredible. Like, it totally holds up. Airplane absolutely holds up. And to see people laughing in all the places that you laugh, and it was really a wonderful comedy experience to see this movie. So listen, rent Airplane, set up a movie night, and watch it with all your friends. Rent a local theater, screen it there. I don't care. Watch this movie again with a group of people. We actually got to do a panel. It was Jim Abrams and David Zucker and Jerry Zucker, and then Robert Hayes, who played Ted Stryker, and they were just wonderful. And to be there with these guys talking about a movie that was one of the movies that defined me as a young comedy person was a tremendous brain boner. I don't know how else to describe it. It was a brain boner. And so here we are, the Nerdist Podcast number 202, the found episode of my panel with the Zucker brothers, Jim Abrams and Robert Hayes. Stryker, 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 Stryker.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey
This seems to be working. I am going to expose this shirt, which I own. And I did not buy it for this. I've owned this shirt for a long time. I paid $100 for it on eBay. It's still worth a lot of money. Please have a huge hand for the film Airplane. Oh my God. I can't even wrap my mind around it. And they were sitting behind me the whole time. It was like childhood nerd boner, if I can say that, which is a weird thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce the directors of Airplane, David Zucker, Jerry Zucker, Jim Abrams, and Robert Hayes. Gentlemen. I think just sort of strewn out here, and I'll sit here in this chair. All right. All right, I'll move over here. This is good. Should I sit here? Do you want... Okay, you take that one. All right, I'll go back here.
Okay.
No, joke ended.
Yeah, that's pretty much.
Timing.
Even now when we watch it, we're thinking, oh, that joke should have ended a second earlier.
Still, you feel that when you...
Yeah. Only see the mistakes.
Yeah. Really? Okay, so what is an example of... Because I think we would all agree the movie is flawless, and still, after... Still, after 31 years, it entirely holds up.
First of all, I have to say, would have been worth it to make this movie and all the time and effort just for this audience.
No
Thank
kidding.
You.
Yeah, this was great to sit.
Seriously, all these years later, is something about just hearing. This kind of a great response is just so much fun and really gratifying. But speaking of we were just talking while we were back there. There's still lots of stuff to us that seems pretty clunky. Obviously the movie works and stuff. But I was just saying to David that one thing that always drives me crazy is in the hospital. It's just like this slow pan at the beginning, and then this kind of stupid joke of the guy with the STP sticker on his back. But just saying, they're playing, and he kind of goes.
You get it?
It's like...
It's STP.
Not exactly a subtle thing in the background, but... There are a lot of those little things, I think.
Well, but you have to... Have you ever watched the movie with a huge audience any time recently?
Yeah, it's like been every month now.
Has it really?
It's the 30-year anniversary, so...
Oh, so they've got you.
Going around to different...
Sure.
Celebrations.
Sure.
Yeah,
so this is old hat by this point.
Doesn't matter.
Taking a nap. But it must be the same response everywhere. I mean, like, you know, there were clusters of people shouting out quotes at this. I mean, it's probably, I would say, you know, this and the Naked Gun series, probably the most quotable films in the history of film. I mean, you...
Casablanca had a few, I think.
And The Godfather.
Not as many.
But this audience was the best
This is the best.
Of course.
Yeah, this is the best.
Of all the 30th anniversary audiences. And we have a special prize.
How does a movie like this get made? I mean, obviously, I was, I loved Kentucky Fried Movie. I know you guys had Kentucky Fried Theater. So maybe we go back a little bit and talk about how Kentucky Fried Movie got made, and was that what led to Airplane?
Wait a minute
for this.
I think you should sit here.
so we switch after every question.
Yeah, because this is for the answer for the. Don't you think so?
I think so.
Maybe. Three together for the answer for Jim.
Jim, and
then we can switch back after the answer.
So the question is, how did Airplane?
Kentucky Fried Movie,
I think. Kentucky Fried Movie. Yeah, yeah. All right, well, the sequence was sort of, Dave and Jerry and I moved from Madison, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where we were doing Kentucky Fried Theater, to Los Angeles in 1971.
Two.
Two. And
I'll coach you here.
Thank you. Yeah. And then we started doing this theater called Kentucky Fried Theater, where we performed and whatnot. And in order to get new material for the theater, what we would do is leave a tape recorder on all night and tape the shows that were on during the evenings, because they tended to be the stupidest, and the commercials tended to be the cheapest, and they were the easiest to satirize. And that's what our theater did. We made fun of stuff like that. So one night we left our tape recorder on, and we got to work the next day, and we played back what we had taped the night before, and it turns out that we'd captured this 1957 melodrama called Zero Hour, starring Linda Darnell and Sterling Hayden and Dana Andrews, and it was Airplane, except a very serious melodrama, written by Arthur Haley. The screenplay was written by Arthur Haley. So it was that was about 1974, and that's when we started saying, this is perfect. Instead of doing little vignettes, maybe we can make a whole story and just add our jokes to it. Then, meanwhile, we started writing Airplane, and not much was happening. And so David eventually called John Landis. John Landis came to see our theater. He said, why don't you take this Kentucky Fried Theater that you're doing, and we'll make that into a movie called Kentucky Fried Movie. So that was made in 77, and we kept pulling Airplane off the shelves and rewriting it. And after Kentucky Fried Movie did okay, then we had an opportunity to make Airplane.
That's not really the way it happened.
That's not the way it happened at all, yeah. I have a completely different recollection.
Who is Rex Kramer? Because the name appears. Isn't Rex Kramer the character from Danger Seekers in Kentucky Fried Movie?
He's a guy that we went to high school with.
And so was Steve McCroskey.
Really?
And in Kentucky Fried Movie, the villain was named Dr. Klon, and that was our high school principal. So it was kind of an in joke. Yeah.
And Robert Hayes, did you audition for this movie, or did you know these guys before? How did you get the role?
I did. The story that I had heard was that they had been going across country, all the cities, all over the country, looking for their Ted Stryker, and they hadn't had any luck. My agent had a woman that had just joined the agency. It's a new agent named Beth Voigt, and she used to work for Howard Koch, who was the godfather. He'd been the former head of production, the president of Paramount Studios, and they put him in charge of exec producing this. And she called him up and said, Howard, I got the guy for you. I've got your Ted Stryker. And he said, bring him over. So I went over, and I met the boys, and we all got along, and then I read, and they liked the reading. And then I screen tested with Julie, and we did the hospital scene with the spit take. And they liked that, and then they said, from what I understand, Paramount was saying you've got to use these big, the hot young comedy actors from Saturday Night Fever, Live or whatever. And they didn't want to use that. They wanted to use the straight people, Bob Stack and Lloyd and Peter. And then for Ted Stryker, it was an unknown. So they cast me. They came over to the set of a series I was doing called Angie.
I remember that show.
And they came backstage. And they said, you're the one. You're the one we want. And I said, great. And we all jumped a little, and then they left. And Jim told me later that they said, gosh, we've cast him. Maybe we ought to look and see what it is that he does. Now, that was a sitcom. That was totally different. And so they went home, and they watched an episode of Angie, and they said, oh, shit. But it was different. I was actually insane, and I think that lent itself to the film.
Let the times grow, let the love grow, let the rain shower, let the roses flower.
That's the theme to Angie.
Wow.
It is.
Yes, so it is.
Tom Waits sang that. That would be the scene.
It's a very cutting-edge show. Donna Pesco, right? That's right. Absolutely remember that show.
That's right. Yeah.
Did you have any idea when you first... Did you read the script before you auditioned, or did you just get a couple
I
pages?
Read the script on an airplane going to Minneapolis. I was sitting on the plane. It was an ABC function, and we went back with Howard Cosell and Donna Pascal and a whole bunch of people. We went back to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and they were having an NBC station becoming ABC, and it was a huge station, so it was very important. We went back there, and I read the script on the plane. And as I was reading it, there was literally something on every single page that made me laugh out loud. I didn't just smile. I mean, something made me laugh out loud on every single page. And the stewardess, she came over and she said, I couldn't help but notice you seem to be enjoying that. And I said, well, it's a script called Airplane. Would you like to read it when I'm done? She said, yes, thank you very much. She had a bun. She was very prim, proper. She looked like Elaine, only with her hair done up in a tight little bun. She sat down on her little fold-down stewardess seat, had her knees together, and she opened the script and she started reading. And a little while later, I looked up and I saw her kind of giggling a little bit. A little while later, I saw her just relaxing a little bit. And a little while later, her knees were apart, her bun was undone, and she was laughing. And then afterwards, she kind of did herself up and said, thank you.
I mean, I don't... So when you read it, you got it right away. I mean, because I'm trying to think... There wasn't really any other type of comedy like this at the time. So did the other actors, did the straight actors, did they know what you were doing? Did they understand?
Well, Bob. Well, Leslie Nielsen did.
Yeah.
And I think Leslie said to his agent, I would do this for nothing. Don't tell him, but I'll do it for nothing. Yeah.
Wow. Well, Leslie, they all actually fit into it in different ways. Leslie, although he played these straight roles all his life, was truly a closet comedian. I mean, he was really a nutty, zany, wonderfully funny guy, and he just loved doing this. Peter Graves, I think, his wife liked the script, and we, and between his family and Howard Koch, they talked him into doing it, and he was the sweetest guy on the set and would do whatever we asked, but I don't think he really got right. what he was doing.
I guess that moment, why am I telling this child about a Turkish prison?
Well, don't, just let it. It's fine.
It'll be fine.
We told him that's explained later in the part that he's not in.
When he first read it, he said, this script is the most disgusting piece of trash I've ever read in my life.
And we said, thank you.
I think Lloyd Bridges was, the way we went about writing it is we just had this old movie Zero Hour, and we thought we'll just add jokes, and it wasn't written the way scripts are traditionally written. We just added jokes. So I think what happened with Lloyd is that he read this script and he saw this guy who was smoking and drinking and doing amphetamines and sniffing glue, and so he tried to put the way lots of actors tried to put together this guy's personal agenda and tried to make it sense within the character of probably some guy who was tortured as a child and whatnot. And all, just snort the glue, Lloyd.
There was actually one rehearsal where Stack was great. Stack, although not really a comedian, he got it. He said, okay, I get it. I am the joke, and we are. But there was one rehearsal where, Lloyd Bridges was saying, well, why would my character say the line, da da da? And Stack just looked at me and said, Lloyd, look at the script. There's a watermelon falling, down in front of you. There's a spear going in the wall behind me. Just keep talking, Lloyd. Nobody's looking at us. So he was helpful.
When I was in college, I worked at a country club, and Robert Stack was a member there. And of course, even at that point, I had already seen Airplane 100 times, and so I asked him about it, and he said, "Oh, I want to tell you a little story." He said, "Those Zucker brothers. I don't know if this is true. This is just what Robert Stack said. They came to me with the Naked Gun idea, and I turned it down. And God damn it if that Leslie Nielsen hasn't made a fucking millions of dollars." So I don't know if that's true, but that's what he said to me when I was in college and I met him. Is that true?
It's true. We went to Robert Stack first because we just...
It pissed him off that it worked out.
He was the much bigger star at the time, and I think the studio also liked the idea.
Yeah, we just thought Robert Stack was the funniest human on the planet. I mean, he's just it's his ship now. It's command. He's the top dog. The big, you know.
God corrected our mistake. But
he was doing the Unsolved Mysteries or something. So he was doing that. So he couldn't. He really couldn't. He couldn't do it.
He couldn't go off and do it.
He couldn't go off and do it, yeah.
It was so hard. It was so hard when Leslie Nielsen, may he rest in peace, Leslie Nielsen, but when he came on screen, it was so hard not to shout from the back of the theater, "Hey, look, it's Enrico Palazzo!" What was the experience like working with him? I mean, he seemed like a sweetheart.
He was. He was absolutely... He was great to work with, and, you know, he...
Leslie, you know, Leslie has a machine. Had a machine. They called it a machine. It was a little. It was a handheld whoopee cushion. And he could play it like a symphony. He could play. I mean, he could fart like Ernest Borgnine or Sandy Duncan. I mean, it covered the whole range.
Anywhere on the Borgnine Duncan scale.
And in the scene, I remember sitting there when we first were starting out, and I was sitting in my little chair, and I really was just so proud of it. And two girls came in that were extras, and one of them said, "Oh, there's Leslie Nielsen. I'm going to go say hi." And she went over there, and just like, I don't know, 45 seconds later, she came back and said, "Do you know what he did?" Because it doesn't matter who, if he meets the president, you know. Nice to meet you. So when we were shooting the scene in the cockpit, "Mr. Stryker, can you land this plane?" "Well, I flew single-engine fighters in the war, but this is four engines and entirely different kind of flying all together." When I was doing that scene, he was on my close-up. It was, "Mr. Stryker, can you land this plane?" It was hard. And he brought a whole box of those and was selling them around on the set. So when the AD would say, "Okay, roll sound. Sound, speed, camera, speed," everybody had those. And one day, Jerry had it. And he said, "All right, I want those off the set."
No recollection. But it was with him on we were on an elevator during a press tour for Naked Gun, and he did it on just watch the other people in this crowded elevator try to press themselves against the edge. But,
and he said it was always fun watching them smell things that weren't there.
When you think about it, I mean, and Leslie, this predated our meeting. Leslie, he did, I think, probably from a very young age, but he loved the idea of doing a silly thing, acting really serious, you know. So even in the elevator, he wouldn't crack up. He would just be really serious about the whole thing, and you know, that fit in perfectly to the kind of humor that we wanted to do. So that I think more than any of those guys, we had a camaraderie with. We're more in sync with Leslie.
You must have been like messiahs to him, because he'd been doing such serious drama for decades before you guys came along. That at some point it was like, "Yeah, all right, Leslie, stop hanging around. We get it." Like, you know, did he come up with pitch a lot
like
of ideas?
One of those stories about the prince who's frozen in ice for 1,000 years, and you know, we finally came and set him free or whatever. I mean, he was really a closet comedian, and he was internally grateful to us. For giving him this opportunity, and not really so much in, you know, when we were negotiating a contract on the new film, but
yeah. I worked on a show for a while with Tino Insana, who wrote for Police Squad.
Right.
So naturally, I grilled him a lot about that. I had episodes of Police Squad that I ripped off Netflix on my iPhone because I travel so much. I would just watch them over and over, and I was asking about Ring of Fear. And he said, "Well, the way that the Zuckers would work is, and Abrams, you would just sit in a room and just watch really serious stuff for hours and hours and hours and just figure out where to jam the jokes in." And when you watch, especially when you watch Airplane, it's the most densely packed, like, joke, like jokes per minute, and they all land.
Well, that really came from our stage show because, you know, we were up on stage and we hated it when the audience wasn't laughing. So we just kept the pace going so that we would be less embarrassed when we were on stage.
Yeah. What were the theater shows like when you were doing the live theater shows?
It was sketch comedy. It was an hour and a half and just, you know, blackouts, sketches. Yeah. We had a television monitor on stage where we showed parodies of TV commercials. And so we ran three shows over about 5 years. And the first one was called Vegetables. And the second one was called My Nose, just so the listing in the LA Times, the weekly listing, would say, My Nose Runs Continuously. But all this time, we really wanted to do these movies. You know, we didn't want to be dancing around on stage live. And so, finally, you know, we recast the show, and so we really set around full time writing Airplane and Kentucky Fried Movie, and our last show was called Beating a Dead Horse. It was a combination of the previous show.
To give you an idea of what went on in the show, for intermission, there was a phone that would drop from the ceiling right down to the middle of the audience, and it would be ringing, and it would land right in the audience member's lap. And so eventually the people in the audience would say, well, pick it up. And he'd pick it up, and somebody from backstage would say to the guy, would you please tell the audience it's intermission? So the guy would hang up the phone and go, it's intermission.
The other thing was that Steve Stucker, who plays Johnny, was in our live show for years.
He was the piano player.
Yeah. And also acted. Yeah, you know, acted, just yeah. I mean, he did. And he, you could have, the three of us who were also in the show, we could have sent up a flare and nobody would have seen us. I mean, everyone was glued to Steve because he was so outrageous and funny.
How much of the film, was there any improvisation in the film, or were you guys pretty tight with the script?
People would ask me all the time about that.
Why you?
Because they said there was something about you guys. They were deathly afraid of you. No. They said they're too funny. They may say something that'll just hurt. No. The script, I guess you guys worked on it. Maybe it was because you were shelving it because you were working on the other show. So they worked on it for like 5 years, and it was so tight. The only one that really did any improvisation, I think, was Steve Stucker, right?
Not really. His line. See, we couldn't write for Stucker. It was just his line. So what we did, we for instance, in his, the press conference that he answers the questions from the reporters, we fed him the questions. We called him up on the phone, and he said over the phone, and he gave those answers. Those were all his lines. He just said, "Oh, it's a big white plane with red stripes. It's a big Tylenol." And so, and we cracked up, and so we just write it down. And then it was pretty much the same with the black dudes when we had the idea that we would subtitle it, but you know we wrote like. All we knew was mofo, I think. And so it's the best that three white Jewish guys could do. And so these guys, Al White and
Norm Gibbs
came in to do their reading, and they had this whole pattern, exactly what you see in the film. They just had that, and so we just, you know, we let them do it. So, but nothing was improvised on the set except for things that ideas we would think up on the set, like when they were shaking the woman. Mm-hmm. I think the first three people were scripted, and then all the people with the whips and the guns and the knives, that was added. So we sent our prop person out to get all that stuff.
That's incredible. So everything really, you really had every joke planned.
We worked on the script for 5 years. So yeah, we would argue over every word. So.
I mean, one of the things that I think makes the film watchable as many times as I'm sure we've all watched it is the just Easter eggs left and right. I mean, even just watching it tonight, for some reason I had never gotten the joke before where you say to Elaine, we're coming in from the north below the radar, and she says, when are you coming home? And you say, I can't tell you that. I never picked up on that before, and it sawed me in half, and seeing it with these people. Was there anything that you guys saw in the audience new tonight? What was an example of something that you saw that you didn't notice before?
The whacking material.
I'm telling you, seeing it on the big screen, you know, I actually saw Airplane in the theater when I was a kid, and ever since then, I've just seen it on a small screen. So are there things that you forgot about, or are there Easter eggs that you feel like, because people have been watching it on a small screen for so long, is there anything that you still feel like people miss that they didn't catch?
No.
Okay.
I'm just curious, how many people here saw it tonight on a big screen for the first time?
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Most people, yeah. Wow. So interesting.
It's a little different.
There's a lot of young people. I was wondering if, because I don't know if the young people know when she says, that's funny, Jim never has a second cup of coffee at home. Is it a Maxwell House commercial?
They,
that's an old,
that weren't they, be, yeah. They were, or at least I think she was in that commercial, wasn't she? I think so. It seems to me like I had heard that. Maybe she had told me that.
Fortunately, we stayed away from too much topical stuff, which I think is one reason why it lasts. Mm-hmm.
I also hadn't noticed before that the guy who samurais himself is James Hong.
Yeah.
Who's in Big Trouble in Little China, and he was in Chinatown, and a lot of movies with China in the title.
I didn't know that.
You know what else? If you notice the...
First I hear of it.
Right during the opening credits, the first guy who says I think it's Julie, would you like take this for the Church of Religious Consciousness, is Greg Itzen, who was the president in 24.
Really?
And a classmate of ours at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Wow. I also noticed David Leisure, a.k.a. Yeah. Joe Isuzu. Yeah.
One of the Hare Krishna. Yeah.
It's one of the...
Did you see Michael Jackson in the...
Small part.
What was it like directing Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
It's a strain on the neck.
Did he understand? Did he understand what you guys were doing, or did you?
I mean, he did. He wasn't that interested in acting, really.
Right.
So,
or that interested in Airplane.
He wasn't.
I don't think so.
No.
He did it because he at first turned it down, but he wanted to buy this antique Oriental rug for $30,000. And his business manager told him that you have to do this movie to buy the rug, and that's really why he did it.
What's the story about?
When the guy first called, we offered 30, and he said, "No, it's got to be 35 because Kareem wants to buy this rug." We thought this is the greatest line we've ever heard. You know,
that was absolutely
agent,
true.
You know, but we thought, oh, you know, it's Kareem. Okay, we'll pay him 35, and like 2 weeks later, there was an article in Time magazine with showing Kareem in front of this rug that he had just bought.
Yeah, but he was completely nice.
Oh yeah, he's
yeah, he was a great guy, but. He didn't want to memorize any lines, but we were saved by the fact that it was, you know, the pilots were all facing forward, so he's just reading it off of cards, the whole part. And when he turned to the kid, the cue cards were there. Kid,
Let me put it this way. It's probably really fortunate that our intention was to make fun of athletes who can't act.
That was the whole purpose.
Initially, we wrote the part for Pete Rose, and that was before Pete Rose was known to be the guy he is. And but we filmed Airplane during the summer, so we had to rewrite it, and that's when they were playing baseball. So we rewrote the part for Kareem kind of late in the game.
I would love to know. There are a couple of people who pop up in the movie that I've always wondered who they are. Like the boy trapped in the fridge eats on foot. Who is that? Is that picture of someone?
The That's little boy.
Howard W. Koch's grandson.
Okay. What about the white zone couple?
40 years old.
Oh. Well, in fact, those are the people who actually make the recording at Los Angeles Airport. We got the actual people. But
they're not actors.
And they're not actors. But the cool thing, I mean, part of the cool thing, I guess that was cool enough, but our notion was, you know, to make fun of whatever the white zone, red zone thing, but we weren't sure how, and so we just knew they had to say something outrageous, and we couldn't think of anything. So we went to the corner drugstore and got a, you know, one of those dime store
the romance
soft
novel.
Cover romance novel. And sure enough, in the romance novel, there's this couple having an argument about an abortion.
And we took it word for word.
And literally, it said, well, but if it's done properly, therapeutically, I think it's all, you know.
There's not that much original in the movie.
What are these people? Who were these people that did the announcement? Did they work at the airport?
We actually auditioned actors and had, you know, voiceover specialists and comedians, you know, recorded. It was just not working. It just somehow it just didn't seem to be funny for us. And so finally, someone thought, well, let's find the people who recorded, you know, the one that we're used to at LAX. And it turned out they were the people who sold the equipment to the airport. And
a husband and wife team.
Yeah, husband and wife.
Did they have any idea when you said, okay, it's an argument about an abortion, were they like, okay, or did they?
No, I think they got a kick out of it. Hollywood doesn't call often, you know.
They must have thought they're just auditioning every 5 minutes at LAX. Finally, someone called.
It's amazing what actors will do if you just, you know, put the script in front of them. You know, it's like true. Bob Costas, you know. You're excited, feel these nipples. And he was so angry when it came out on screen. You know?
By the way, I'm still not convinced that this isn't a weird dream that I'm gonna have, and I'm gonna like not have pants in a second because I can't believe I watched this movie and now I'm talking to you guys because this movie is constantly used in comic circles as the benchmark. I mean, I was talking about it with comics at SF Sketchfest the other night that you guys ever since you guys, no one else seems to be able to make a comedy like this without, like, oh, we're playing comedy. Like, people don't know how to play it straight anymore. What?
That's
what's
great.
Happening?
What else are people saying?
They worship you. I mean, you influence. You know, you've influenced an entire generation of comics and taught people that it actually can be funnier if you play things straight. But what do you think happened, you know, afterwards where everyone, is it just because people aren't as funny, they don't know what they're doing, or why, it just, the formula seems so, like, workable.
Well, it actually takes more discipline, you know, than you might think to do it this way, and I think, I mean, even if you look at Leslie, I think that when he did other movies, as it, you know, in his career, not with us, I mean, you see him getting a little sillier, you know, and in this movie, I love his performance because it's so serious, and it just, I just, for me, it works the best, but it takes a lot of discipline, and you know, you really have to rein actors in because really it's not as fun for them, except for Leslie, like, you know, he loved that kind of thing, but like you can see Lloyd in this movie, and I think Lloyd is terrific in the film, and I think maybe the different kinds of performances work, but you know, he was the one that we sort of kept holding back the most because he kind of wanted to be funny, and you can still see some of that in the film, but it's takes a lot of discipline to do it.
As an actor, Robert, when you're making the film, does it feel like, do you feel like, oh, I'm not really doing anything, I'm not really being funny, but you just trust that they know what they're doing?
No, the brilliance of it is, I think, is first off, they write the script, and the script was just classically funny. The second thing is casting all of the straight people that they did, and the third thing is knowing to keep them straight, and their timing and their editing and everything that they did on it was so great. But someone asked me about it once, and the only thing I could think of was some of these things that what you're talking about is they have a little astral projection of themselves standing outside themselves when they're acting, and they're looking at the audience saying, isn't this funny? And with us, our little characters were looking at the audience saying, what are you laughing for? This is serious stuff. Which made people laugh even harder. The fun thing for me was getting the crew, we couldn't laugh, and as soon as they'd say cut, they would just all crack up, and that was your payment.
What we used to say to the actors was, don't play it straight, pretend that you don't know you're in a comedy. And that was kind of, I think, our philosophy.
Were there a lot of, were there a lot of outtakes of people just breaking because it was impossible not to?
I don't think so, because it was a short schedule.
Yeah. How long did they have time for outtakes?
How much did it cost to make Airplane?
About $3.2 million.
Wow.
And it made $80 million domestically in the
Jeez.
United States. So it was great because... And the studio couldn't hide it fast enough, so we did see some profit participation.
Did you? I mean, so it makes $80 million, and then does everything change at that time for you guys? Did you feel the weight of it?
We became assholes
instantly.
Deservedly so.
You mean when we became better than you?
He's not wrong.
Actually, I remember right after we had gotten that, I think, first check, and we were walking on the lot, the three of us, and Jim was complaining about something. The basement was leaking or the thing. And then he paused and he said, yeah, but fortunately, it was the same week I became a millionaire.
How is it? I always wonder if directing teams, like, it's hard enough just to get two people to direct a movie. How does a three-man directing team work?
Well, it's not really that difficult. It's just the kind of thing we can do because we've been there so many times before and we know how to do it.
We pretty much do it
the way it is.
That was always the.
The first thing is you have to have an odd number. You can't do it with two or four or six. You've got to have 1, 3, 5, 7 because there's an instant, a vote and an answer. And the other thing I think is that for the three of us, it was we all had the same vision. So our arguments were just how to get there, but we weren't making three different kinds of movies and compromising on that.
We evolved our humor together over a period of 10 years, like that, yeah. But, since the theater, we did it at the theater, and I'm going to be Lloyd Bridges here, and you guys keep doing the thing. So, and the way comedy works is that when we took it in college, what was I saying?
And now a word from...
I was making some kind of a really important point. I can't remember what it was.
It
couldn't be.
Doesn't
couldn't
matter.
That important. Yeah. It's.
You'll tell me tomorrow.
Yeah, it was something, an insight that I had.
Were there jokes? Was there stuff that was cut out? Well, first of all, how much stuff stayed in, and how much stuff cut out? Is there a percentage of stuff you wish could have been in still?
Nothing that was cut out was very funny.
No, but I think originally, I think the first cut was probably close to 2 hours. We probably cut out a half an hour, between gags and just too much setup.
Mm-hmm. And what's an example of a gag that you cut out?
There was a gag where Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack were at the water cooler, and they were arguing about something. Yeah. And they would fill a cup of water and take a drink, and I think Stack threw his cup down and said, "No, we've got to make a monodot or whatever." And then Bridges, was drinking, and when it was his turn, he finished the water and threw down his cup and said, "You crazy? We got to do this." And they kept throwing cups down and back and forth. And as you can see, it's a good thing we didn't put it in because
there were some terrible jokes. We had another at the security area. Some lady sees a guy that she knows and says, "Hi, Jack." And then the security guy's, "Oh God, it was." It's in the deleted scenes in your DVD. But deleted scenes in a comedy DVD, I mean, it's always going to be bad. They if they had been funny, they wouldn't be deleted.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like ridiculous.
Is that the basic rule? Is if stuff makes you laugh, it stays in. If it doesn't make you laugh, it goes.
No. The basic rule is if stuff makes the audience laugh, it stays in, and if the audience doesn't laugh, it goes out. And you can be very passionate and fight for a joke and make sure we film it. Da, 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 da. The first screening, as soon as it falls on deaf ears, you can't get back to the editing room quick enough to get it out.
Was there something that you were really, really into and you're like, why aren't these people catching this joke that you had to lose?
Jerry loved that hijack thing. Yeah. Can't explain taste.
I'm sure there were things that we were. I mean, in all our movies, there are big surprises. In Top Secret, there was this huge joke of where the submarine comes crashing onto the set, and it was like took a day to shoot that, and we just thought, oh, that's a big moment, and it just. I don't even want to describe it with this setup, but it just was flat. I mean, and we couldn't cut it because it was a plot thing, and so we just had to go by quickly. But there's always stuff that just surprises you. You kind of hope that you have 90 minutes of laughs.
Now, I know, obviously, you know, it's sort of hard to have any complaints about the success of the movies and how much you've influenced people, but, I mean, is it when you're out in public, Robert, and you know people are yelling lines at you, or you guys, they're yelling lines from any of the films. Is there a moment where you're like, okay, I get it, I was in it, I know, or does it still kind of tickle you that people are so taken by it?
I think it's great. I people come up and they say, I know you're probably sick of hearing this, but I just thought you were great in Airplane. And I said, well, wait a minute, let's think about that for a second. You're coming up to me to tell me how much you really love something that I did. And I'm supposed to be sick of that? No. I think it's great. I love it. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Great.
Yeah.
We're just a generation of your comedy progeny, basically. I mean, like, you've influenced us so much as comedians. Are there other comics in the audience tonight? Oh, okay. Well, I guess other comics felt influenced enough. But I feel sufficiently influenced. But I know, you know, we don't have a ton of time left. I thought it would be really important to let some people who came out tonight ask some questions. Do we have a roving microphone? Oh, Will, there you are, excellent. You, sir, in the front row.
Is this on? A question for Mr. Hayes. Whenever you're on a plane now, do you ever feel like leaning over to somebody and start talking to them about Macho Grande and Elaine? And also, have you ever taken flying lessons?
I actually am a pilot.
You are?
But I got it before we did Airplane. But I was standing in the airport in New York. They have you go into a little waiting room, and then they put you on a kind of a, I don't know, it's a bus-like thing, but it's on scissors lifts. And then they drive you out to the plane, and you load on. And there was a guy, very flamboyant-looking guy with a big black hat and a black suit, white shirt, and a big black cape, which I noticed him. And we were the only two in the room, and he just sat on the other side, standing on the other side, just kind of staring at me, long hawk, you know, sharp features. And finally, when the room was big enough, he said, I am not going to get on the plane with that man. But he wanted to make sure he had an audience first. But I used to get invited up on international flights. You can go into the cockpit. You used to be able to. You couldn't in U.S. flights, American flights. So going to Europe or Canada or Australia, I used to get invited all the time up. But the one that was the funniest to me was flying to Mexico on Aero Mexico or Air Mexicana. And it was a tennis tournament. John McEnroe had a tennis tournament. We were flying down there, and the stewardess comes up to me and says, "The pilot would like to know, would you like to go into the cockpit?" And I said, "Yes." Now you know why I got the role. So, anyway, he invited me up. I sat in the cockpit. They put the jump seat down and said, "You want to sit down?" I said, "Okay." And they can't close the door. He said, "You want a beer?" I said, "Okay." So they brought me, "Dame una cerveza," and they gave me a beer. And then they pull out and they take off. And he hasn't told me to go back and sit down. He just had me sitting up there the whole time. And I thought, I wonder what the people think about this. And I turned around and I looked, and the entire, every row, every face was leaning like that. So what do you do? I said, "Cheers." We flew all the way down like that. They were sweating the whole way.
For the people listening to the recording of this, the Zucker brothers stabbed themselves in the stomach. So people know there's going to be a laugh. They're not going to know why. Any other questions? Anything? Sorry. Wait. Over there. Get that guy in there. Yes, sir. What is your name?
My name's Jeremy.
Hey, what's
I just want to say I'm 20, and I saw Airplane for the first time when I was 8, and it's the reason why I love comedy. But my question is, I really like the second Airplane movie, but I guess other people don't, but I was just curious.
How old are you?
20. I was just curious, this is for the Zuckers and Jim, why weren't you involved with the second one, or did you have ideas for a second film, or what was the
story? Because it was the kind of movie that only a moron would like.
It's fair. Tough but fair.
Sorry. No. We were out of Airplane jokes. I mean, I think we ran out of jokes three-quarter of the way through this one, you know. But obviously the studio wanted us to do it, and we just didn't want to go back and have to spend another year writing and directing just a movie about with more Airplane jokes. And actually, to this day, none of us have ever seen it. I mean, why?
I saw
okay,
it.
It's a little painful.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
I saw it, yeah.
I thought the first one was better.
Oh, I wanted to ask you how you guys got involved with Elmer Bernstein.
How did you know about that?
Oh, tabloids.
Elmer Bernstein, he did the score for the movie?
I know, yeah. But I think Davison knew him.
I think
Animal
House. He was on a list, you know, and he had done Animal House. He's this great composer, yeah. And we met him, and it turned out, I mean, Elmer has a great sense of humor and was just, he actually was great to work with. Because every time he'd see, you know, whether it be, you know, a rough cut of or a reel or whatever, he'd just cackle every time after time. He'd cackle at all these jokes. He really loved it. And he really got, I mean, when we met him, obviously he's done some, you know, fantastic scores, won Academy Awards. And we said, you know, Elmer, the thing is we want a B score for this movie. We don't want a good score.
So we've come to you.
And he totally got it. He totally, and you can see, he just, you know, he loved the idea of sort of overdoing that, you know, classic corny score.
Great.
Anybody else have a question? Yeah.
I think I might be the only person in this entire theater who has never seen this movie until tonight.
Get out! No stay.
And I absolutely loved it. I just want you to know that. I don't have
a
question.
Thank you.
I have a question for you.
Yes?
Why have you hated comedy until tonight?
I just thought it was a horrible movie, and I never wanted to see it
Thank
until
you.
Now.
Oh, well.
No, I don't know. It's legendary. I knew it was legendary. I don't know. I just never had a chance
So legendary, in fact, you guys just got pulled into the Library of Congress this year, right?
That's right.
Did you know that was... And I was so... I was so impressed with the movie The Library of Congress. I don't know, you just think stodgy, Library of Congress, they don't know. But you know, they pulled in Empire Strikes Back, they pulled in Airplane, and they cited these films as they recognized the cultural significance and the influence that they had on the country. So did the president call you and say, guys, we want to pull this into the library?
Yeah, he calls all the time.
I think we read about it in the newspaper.
Yeah, I just someone emailed me. Congratulations. No, they don't actually let you know, and I don't think any of us had any idea what it was, and still don't really. I mean,
still sinking in.
I guess no. Well, I guess they. First of the question was, you know, is there any money involved, which there wasn't. Or a plaque or something, but no. But apparently they said what they do is they preserve the movie, you know, in the Library of Congress, which is, I mean, great, but it's not like it was just sitting out on Hollywood Boulevard unraveling or something. You know,
I should take this off the fridge. Yeah, all right, I'll put
Paramount
it in a vault.
Paramount owns, you know, vaults and stuff, and they do keep the movie. So yeah. I'm not sure that it's. But it's great. We love it. Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Any other questions?
Yes, this question is for Robert Hayes. Did you think your Shakespearean training at the Old Globe prepared you for this role?
Someone's got
a stalker.
Who's
saying that?
Oh. What was it? Did I think my Shakespearean
training at the Old Globe in San Diego prepared you for this role?
Obviously you know all about that.
We go back.
That's what I based my entire character on was Hamlet. And I think I screwed up a little, but I tried. That was what I was basically going for. How did you know that? How did you know that's where I was? I went back. Gosh, it's been about 15 years ago. I went back and did Mr. Roberts on the 75th anniversary of the Globe there, which was great fun. After having done it on NBC, it was one of those live productions where you do it and you screwed up, like the old days. But that's the last time I was actually there doing something.
Excellent. Any other questions?
When were these deletions made? Because I saw this on the big screen, and I distinctly remember a woman being punched in the face. I laughed. Does one of you...
pissed guy in the ninth row.
Does one of you...
Can you speak up a little bit?
I'm sorry. The joke with the woman being punched in the face, it was gone. Does one of you have a problem punching women in the face? I'm not understanding. Like, when did this happen?
Was that an Airplane too?
What punch? Are you talking about a joke that...
Striker, wham.
Oh, is that the second?
Yeah, that's part two.
Oh, crap.
Oh, shit.
Airplane 2.
Oh, shit. Don't take the mic. Leave the mic before you run out. Leave the mic.
Stop that man.
It was the unfunniest joke I ever saw.
There were so many things about that were glorious. Number one, you were angry because you're like, what's wrong with punching women in the face? All right. Yeah. A. Number two, wrong film. Wah, wah, wah. Oh, this night's going to haunt you for months. For months. I'm going to get your number in a month. I'm going to call you. Remember when you fucked up in the front of the Zucker Brothers? Stop it. It's going to be glorious.
You're starting to make him look really good. You're off the hook. You're great.
Every salmon needs a catfish. All right. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have the mic.
Okay.
I'm wondering if the guy that wrote the Rivers of Jordan, after all these years, if he's still pissed off at you guys for using his song.
Peter Yarrow wrote River of Jordan, and... as far as we know, yeah, he is.
Does he receive residuals from the film?
Pardon me?
Does he receive residuals from the film every time it's shown? Does he make any money off it?
Oh, he wants to know if it's residuals.
Probably.
Do you know who it was? Anybody know? Peter Yarrow? Peter, yeah. Paul, and Mary?
Okay.
The shorter one of the two.
Yeah.
who wasn't blonde.
I guess he wrote the song for a friend's wedding, and apparently he takes it seriously. I don't get it.
Just begrudgingly cashing these huge checks. I'll take the $100,000, but I won't be happy about it. Yes, sir.
Who? I'm sorry. Who played the girl who the topless girl?
You want to call her now?
Yeah.
I got a fetish.
She's
60.
I'll give you her number, but she doesn't look like that anymore.
Yeah. She has a penis.
That was my son's favorite part of the movie when he was two. And we would watch it together over and over again. And I was into it because of the boobs, and he saw it as food. So it was, we had this great thing.
It makes me, every time I see that boob scene, it just makes me think of Catholic high school girls in trouble. Who was Samuel L. Bronkowitz?
That was a fictitious character that we made up because for Kentucky Fried Movie, we were having trouble renting equipment, and because we were just a production company, just a bunch of kids. So you know, we would call up and say, we want to rent this crane or something, and who's that for? It's for Samuel L. Bronkowitz Productions. And one lady says, "Is he still alive?" So, it worked.
All right, we have time for a few more questions. Who else?
Yeah, I have a question about a couple jokes over here on the right side. Chris, over here.
Right here. Oh, I see. Okay, I got you.
Oh, my right, yeah.
Yep.
There's a couple jokes that I love, but I don't understand at all where they came from. One is, and maybe it's just because I don't understand the reference, but one is the horse in the bed. why she's sleeping with a horse in her bed. And
oh, come on now.
I mean,
just let you.
All right,
think
why
about
not?
It.
Sure. And also, Leon's getting larger is one of my favorite quotes, but I just don't understand where that comes from. I mean, considering the line before.
Okay, so there are three of you now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Leon's getting larger. I mean, Stucker used to, backstage at the show, he would go up to a person who was overweight, and he would grab their tummy and say, "Would anyone care for a roll in coffee?" And so we just had kind of adapted that for that.
Did he Stucker do other stuff?
Stucker was not to be believed. He was just the most amazing guy. Be all the more amazing, I think, for us because we grew up in a very provincial Midwestern town in the 50s and 60s. And when we got out here and started to do our show and we're looking for a piano player, and this guy walked in, and what you see in Airplane is way toned down from the real Stephen. He was just a marvelous guy. And in addition, when he was 15, he was a soloist with the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra. So he's a brilliant musician, too. And after we would do our shows, he would play the piano in our shows. And we would sit around into the wee hours of the morning, and he would play this piano, and it would almost, like levity, it would almost become alive. And he'd do Elton John, and he'd do symphony stuff, and he'd do Beethoven, and he'd do everything. And he was just kind of a genius guy.
I always wonder why I never saw him in anything else. Did you know if he got offers or if he just didn't want to do other stuff?
There's not a lot of call for that. in a lot of, I mean, he's a very particular, you know, type. Sure. And I think he did do some movies, but it was. Right.
And he's not alive anymore.
He died in 1986.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize it was that long ago. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we should.
It's all over. Everyone, get out. I would pick you. Clearly, you will. But there's no microphone. We need a microphone. We'll get to you. I promise. I promise.
She can shout it.
Let her shout.
Sure. I think you've proven that you can. Yes.
Was that shouting?
Okay, so if just for anyone who didn't hear that over here, what comedies you've enjoyed in the last 10 years, and secondly, if you think comedy is doing better on television now.
I don't know, mainstream comedies, I like The Hangover quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
That made me laugh a lot, I think. In terms of... I mean, I always like to see comedy in the theater because filmed comedy, because you see it with an audience. And I hate laugh tracks, so I would answer the second part, no.
David, is there anything that you've enjoyed in the last...
Have you been out in the last 10 years?
I haven't really been out that much. I can't think of anything went out and laughed. I don't know.
In terms of, I think what influenced us more was Mad Magazine. And in particular, there was a column in Mad Magazine, and we've sort of touched on it indirectly tonight a little bit, where they would do scenes we'd like to see, where they would do a parody of a scene from a movie. And in each panel, it would be dead straight. The characters would be straight, hence, you know, the casting of Stack and Bridges and Nielsen. And the backgrounds would be straight. There were no cartoonish things in the background. And, you know, hence that led to a serious score by Elmer and stuff like that. And each panel of the cartoon would be pretty straight until the last panel, when they would make whatever their joke was. And that was sort of the model for our approach to Airplane, was everything should be set up exactly the way you're used to seeing it in a real movie, and then at the end we'll do something silly for the joke.
Great. Do you have any idea how that applies to your question?
Oh,
do you want to shout another one?
Television.
I think she said, yeah. Okay. You said and magazine as well, right? Robert, what about you? What are you enjoying in the last few years, comedy-wise?
I haven't gotten out much lately either. I watch things that my boy is going to be 20 in a week, so I've been guided by what he watches. Otherwise, I don't watch anything. And he's hooked on The Office.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me to Napoleon Dynamite.
Nice.
And I came out angry and feeling dumber than when I went in. But then he started doing his impressions of the lines, and that made me laugh. Then we went back and saw it again, and then I laughed. And then it was very funny to me. But,
I think we have time for two more questions. Yes.
Well, I know you guys had directed this film together as a trio, and then you went off and did some of your own films. And didn't one of you guys direct Ghost? And was it parodied later in one of the other films you'd done?
Yes.
Simple answer. Do you have any stories behind that? You guys.
Yes, I directed Ghost, and David did a parody of it in, it was actually as the trailer, and then in Naked Gun 2.5?
Yes, 2.5 was the, so we, yeah.
I think this poor guy all night. Yes, give him his due.
Thank you.
What's your name, sir?
My name is Jason.
Okay, Jason, I don't want to put any pressure on you. You are the very last question tonight.
Okay. Let me think of how to phrase this so I don't get stuck with those three guys.
Okay.
Okay.
Right now, you just won.
Okay. I have to ask this of any writers that I see in person. Do you have any advice for aspiring screenwriters?
Quit now, you'll never make it. But if you can ignore that advice, then you'll be halfway there. So, but, you know,
I think the best advice I would give you want a comedy write? You want to make do movies? What are you interested in?
I want to do movies.
Movies. Any particular kind? Just
I actually focus primarily on science fiction, but I love comedy
too. Science fiction, great. Okay.
Well, different advice for different genres?
No.
It's the first I hear of this.
If you want to write sci-fi, try and befriend a magical creature.
I want to hear this.
I want to give him something helpful.
Something that he can take home.
No, I'm enjoying this. I want to prolong this as long as I can. I would say the best advice is just to keep writing. And that's great. thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. But to if you have a friend, if you fancy yourself as a filmmaker or have a friend, it's so inexpensive now to make movies, not for theatrical distribution, but even that has come down a lot. But make movies with videotape or with this inexpensive equipment, and just even do 10 minutes. Just or 15 minute or 3 minutes, just short, and then show them to people. Right. And if you have a bunch of friends that you want to do that with, have a little, a screening of 3 or 4 of these things. And the most important thing I would say for your education and your growth as a writer-director is to see reaction from an audience and to try to get honest reaction from an audience.
Hence, maybe it's not even the best idea to show it to friends. Show it to people. It's certainly we learned the most when we would put a movie up in front of people who didn't know us, didn't care about us, wanted to be entertained, and they're brutal and ruthless. And sometimes when you work on stuff and you just show it to your mom and dad and your friends and stuff like that, they care about you too much to be ruthless. And you need that ruthless critique from an objective audience to really learn. I mean, that's really the 5 or so years that we were doing Kentucky Fried Theater. It was a clinic for us. Those audiences paid. They didn't know us or care about us, and when they didn't laugh, we learned a ton.
Excellent. That was a great question, and that was certainly a great answer, and we're out of time. So, number one, thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for making some of the greatest films that we have as comedians. Robert Hayes, Jim Abrams, Jerry Zucker, David Zucker, thank you so much for coming out to the Castro Theater.
Thank you, Chris, and thank all of you.
Thank you.
Janet, Cole, and David, thank you for having me do this. This was an entirely amazing dream come true. Thank you, gentlemen.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup, automatic and secure online backup for your home and small business computer files with plans starting at $59 a year. Get the better backup plan today. Start your free trial at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Nerdist and get 2 bonus months with purchase.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.